Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com.
We'll be looking at first chapter of 2 Samuel this evening, just the first 16 verses. And what we are going to look at is first the crossover between 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel and try and piece together some puzzle pieces that we've got, because what we have here is we find converging of timelines, you might say. There's most likely at least 6 days, more likely 8 days or a short amount of time between 1 Samuel chapter 27 towards 2 Samuel chapter 1. We noted before that the time span of David's fleeing could be 8 or 12 years, depending on how young David was when he first defeated Goliath and when that running began. We don't know for sure, but it's a long amount of time that often we just gloss over. Out of all the what we have, a lot of time is spent to these 8 or so days. And a lot has happened in this time that we might have forgotten as we had the introduction to 2 Samuel, the conclusion to 1 Samuel, all these different chapters in the middle of trying to piece this all together. So just a lot of time and space has happened. David is now back in Ziklag, and after being sent home from Aphek, and we're given a couple of pieces of information about the days and the time of days, 3 days after it took him to journey from Aphek to Ziklag, and then the journey in the middle. And then 2 Samuel chapter 1 verse 2 explains that on the third day, a man came up to Saul's camp and his clothes torn and dirt on his head. And when he came to David, he fell on the ground and paid homage. So before we get into the content of 2 Samuel chapter 1, I want to kind of piece together how these timelines intersect, that these timelines cross over. That we remember chapter 28, where Saul goes to see the medium at Endor, actually happens later in the chronological timeline, for she says that tomorrow you will die. But it happens before as this prophecy of what's going to happen. It's not until chapter 31 that he actually dies. But in between all this time, all these things are happening. But these crossovers of Saul and David are going on, and the author of Samuel, Gad at this point, I believe, is running these stories parallel to one another, that we're crossing over a lot. We're going back to David. We're going back to Saul. And we're following these. And it starts in chapter 29. The Philistines gathered their forces at Aphek, and the Israelites encamped at the spring of Jezreel. So Aphek, back to that map there, is up the top of the map, and then further up north and further to the east, there's where the Israelites are camping in the beginning of chapter 29. And so you have these timelines cross over. That's where they're located. They're separate from one another. But David leaves early in the morning, chapter 29, verse 10. He rises early in the morning after the five lords of the Philistines come to him and say, "You're not going into battle with us." He rises early in the morning. He leaves then for Ziklag, and then the Israelites, the Philistines, went up to Jezreel. So they're following up to Jezreel where the Israelites are camped. That's where they were. And so the Philistines go up to Jezreel. Now it's, you go back to David. David comes down. He goes to Ziklag. It takes 3 days to leave from Aphek down to Ziklag. And they come there and they're burned with fire. You remember the story. They come in, there's 600 men, they go chase them down. Shall we overtake them? And the Lord says, overtake, save, deliver. And they go down, and they come down, and they leave the 200 men at Besor. And then they come and meet the Egyptian, providence. But he's been left there 3 days as well. We're left this time. So they meet this Egyptian, they give him, and they explain in chapter 30, verse 12, that he's been there for 3 days and 3 nights. So he then goes, we don't know the time frame between how long it takes them to chase down the Amalekites, the Ammonites. We don't know that time frame, but it says that in chapter 30, verse 17, that he struck them down from twilight until the evening of the next day. So he's fighting these Ammonites for roughly about a 24-hour period with these 400 men, and then the 400 separate men flee. And then he returns to Ziklag and comes to Ziklag. He sends his spoils to the elders of Judah. And then now we come to 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 2. On the third day, behold, a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and on his head. Now, what we have, we've had that timeline happening with David, what happened with David. But interwoven throughout all this has been what's happening with Saul, what's happening with the Israelites, what's happening with the Philistines. The Philistines there gathered at Aphek in Jezreel. Aphek is where David is sent home from the five lords of the Philistines. And then the Philistines go up to Jezreel where the Israelites were. And then the Philistines in chapter 28 were told that they came to encamp at Shunem. And Saul gathered all Israel and they camped at Gilboa. So now they're further moving. Gilboa is further to the east of Jezreel. So they're moving across, and the Philistines are closing in on them, getting closer to them. And it's here in chapter 28 that's where Saul goes and sees the medium at Endor. Now, all this is happening in Ziklag when we read through the chapter, but 28 happens right before chapter 31, that he goes the night before and he's told by Samuel that you will die. So they go and they camp at Gilboa, and then Saul goes to the medium at night, and the medium, Samuel says in chapter 28, verse 19, he says, "Tomorrow you and your son shall be with me, and the Lord will give the army of the Israel also into the hands of the Philistines." So now we then jump to chapter 31 from 28, we jump to 31, where the Philistines were fighting against Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. So here they are in Gilboa, they run up, they try and run away into the mountains of Gilboa, and they die there. And then verse 6, "And Saul died, his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his men on the same day together." Again, that prophecy back to chapter 28, the prophecy been fulfilled by Samuel, coming to happen in 31. And Jabesh, they came at night. Remember the people from Jabesh Gilead right before from chapter 13 in 1 Samuel. But Jabesh Gilead come at night to grab the body of Saul. And when they'd heard that Saul's body was hung on the temple, and they went at night and took the body and the sons from the wall of Bashan, and they came to Jabesh and burned him there. And they mourned for 7 days as well. But David at this point has had no contact with the Philistines after being sent away from Aphek. That space of time in that, David is doing his own thing in a different, at the bottom of Israel, down at in Ziklag. And then right at the north end of Israel is where the battle is happening with the Philistines. So here's this two separate timelines, and they're just happening. David's come back from rescuing his two wives and all the people and all the spoil. But all these two timelines now come together, and they're joined together. And time, space and time, is completely different to how we are today. We can... I remember when 9/11 happened. September 12th is my birthday, so in Australia is about 16 hours in front. So I get home from school, and I turn on the TV, and I heard, and basically, I was able to watch what was happening on 9/11 that very day, that very moment, across the world, in a matter of minutes, in a matter of seconds, and even now, it's even more so. I mean, we have newspapers in our pockets, you know, to be able to go pull up news articles immediately, to be able to find that type of information. It doesn't take long for news to be able to spread, but this is not the world that they live in. You had to send things via people. The news to be able to get something from the north of Israel to the south in Ziklag would take days. It took David 3 days with his 600 men to travel from Aphek down to Ziklag. And that's what happens here. 3 days. It also most likely takes this person about 2 or 3 days on his own to be able to come back down to Ziklag to be able to inform David of what's actually happened in this separate timeline up in this northern part of the wall. And this is where the timelines meet. And we see this in the first 3 verses. After the death of Saul, when David had returned from striking down the Amalekites, David remained 2 days in Ziklag. And on the 3rd day, behold, a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and the dirt on his head. And when he came to David, he fell on the ground and paid homage. David said to him, "Where did you come from?" And he said to him, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." And here, David finally meets someone who comes from the camp of Israel. But you just imagine, your whole army is wiped out. Who's then going to go pass on the information that that they've been destroyed? You know, all this type of information been passed on. So David asks, "Where do you come from?" And here we find the Amalekites' version of the story of what has happened in the past in verses 4 to 10. The Amalekite explains where he came from and that I came from the camp of Israel. And David asks the question, how did it go? What happened? You know, there's no checking the score of a football game on your phone right as it happened, you know, or asking someone, did you see the score? This is what happened. Who won, Israel or the Philistines? He doesn't know. So he asks this question, how did it go? Tell me, he says in verse 4. And he answered, "The people fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead. And Saul and his son Jonathan are dead." Then David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" And the young man who had told him said, "By chance, I happened to be on Mount Gilboa. And there was Saul leaning on his spear. And behold, chariots and the horsemen were close upon him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me. And I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' And I answered him, 'I am an Amalekite.' And he said to me, 'Stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers.' So I stood beside him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arm, and I brought them here to my lord." Now, just pause and note the irony of this situation. It's an Amalekite that comes and tells of Saul's death. Now, who was Saul meant to wipe out in chapter 15? But the Amalekites. He was meant to take the Amalekites. But yet here, it's the Amalekites who says that Saul and his house has been wiped out as he talks to David. Now, the first question you might have, if your memory is good, which mine is not, but the first question you might have is back to chapter 31. You have this account just a page before where there's a completely different story, right? It's similar in some respects. They fled to the Mount Gilboa. There was Saul, and Saul was left alone. But then Saul had fallen on his spear. And Saul talks to the Amalekite and says, "Well, you destroyed me." And the Amalekite says, "Well, I took him out of his misery. I destroyed him." The chapter in 31 explains it this way. "Then Saul said to his armor bearer, 'Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and mistreat me.' But his armor bearer would not, for he feared greatly. Therefore Saul took his own sword and fell upon it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell upon his sword and died with him." So, but in one chapter, we have what happened in chapter 31, and then this different account here. And in chapter 31, he says that he doesn't want to be killed by a Philistine, an uncircumcised person. But here, the Amalekites, he's begging this Amalekite to be able to destroy him. But here, it doesn't seem to be the concern. Another difference is that in chapter 31, it speaks of his sword, that he fell on his sword in chapter 1. It mentions that he fell on his spear. So what do we do when we come to discrepancies like this? Apparent discrepancies that appear in the Bible that when you look at them, you don't understand where the difference is. Now, the first thing is what liberal scholars would do is they basically just say that it's a human error, and therefore, this is a reason why we cannot trust the Bible. That when the editor was putting the Bible together, the editor 500 BC, long after this has happened, when he's piecing together all these stories, he was editing the story and he forgot. You know, he forgot what he had edited before, and he just copied and pasted and put it in this story, and he didn't go through and, you know, fine-tune it. Now, that's the liberal scholar's version, and most of the time, we just don't, it's just a simple answer, but they don't necessarily do a lot of digging. I've spoken off this before, and I won't spend a lot of time on it. But the second is that maybe we could take maybe a hybrid of this model and say, well, maybe there's a partial truth in it that, you know, Saul fell on his sword in chapter 31. He didn't die. And the Amalekite comes up and he has this conversation with this Amalekite. And the Amalekite just gets some general detail incorrect, such as the sword and the spear. He just doesn't remember that correctly. And you can try and maybe marry these two stories together and say, well, the Amalekite's telling a version of that story that he remembers. Now, you could do that, but I think the sometimes the simplest solution is the right solution. I've explained before, I'm not a gymnast, so don't try and do all this gymnastics to try and make it work. I just try and understand maybe the simple reading of this. And I think this is where the third response comes down to. The Amalekite is just lying. The Amalekite is telling a story, and he is lying. In chapter 31, we have the narrator who's telling us what happened. The narrator is under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. He comes up and he tells us the events of what happened on that day when Saul and his sons fell in battle. And then what you have is the Amalekite coming, and the narrator doesn't then try to explain the difference. He's just explaining what the Amalekite said. He's recording history accurately. And he's recording how the Amalekite came to David and said what he did. And this is important when we come to the end of this section, because it's the Amalekite who confesses himself that he took Saul's life. Now, Dale Ralph Davis makes very interesting comments, and sometimes when I'm reading his commentary, he has a way of making me giggle or laugh out loud. And one of his passing comments that made me laugh during this time, and he said, "If you ever have a choice between a narrator and an Amalekite, always believe the narrator. Have you ever met an Amalekite you could trust?" So here, we just look at that simple, it does make sense, the Amalekite's lying. Now, the narrator, sometimes it's hard in the Bible because the narrator, the recorder of our historical books particularly, they don't necessarily give us color-coded morals and ethics when it comes to situations. Often, you know, we look at things and we can try and understand, is this good or bad, based on what God has revealed in His Word. But they don't necessarily stop and say, what the Amalekite did was wrong on this day, or the Amalekite was lying. They don't necessarily go into details like that. The narrator generally just records history as it happens. And so that's what he does. So then comes the question, how did he get the crown and the armlet? Obviously, this is a big, you know, if I came in and said, this is Queen Elizabeth's crown, you know, you would be able to quite quickly maybe know Google search and see whether it was real. You'd be able to see. And David had seen this crown before. He'd seen this armlet. It would be hard to be able to lie about having these things. But here he has this crown and this armlet. Now, it's hard to be able to decide motives and understand what's really behind the Amalekite's thinking when he's doing this. I mean, Doeg the Edomite was willing to do anything for power. He was willing to wipe out the whole house of Ahimelech at the command of Saul. And I think what he was doing there is he thought that maybe if he could get on Saul's good side, it would be good for him. And so maybe this is the thinking of the Amalekite, that if he comes to David and says, look, I killed your enemy who has chased you down for 8 to 12 years, you know, then maybe David might look fondly upon him, maybe give him an ability to be able to high ranks in his house, trying to impress David. But we also need to remember that David had just struck these Ammonites, the Amalekites as well, and had this large spoil. So David had gone through and taken out the Amalekites. And now maybe this Amalekite is saying, well, I can't go back home. They've been wiped out. I have nothing. So maybe if I come and try and get on David's side, who just wiped out my people or scared them away, then maybe I might be able to have somewhere to live and not be worried. You know, the friend of my enemy is whatever that saying is. Then maybe if I just go and make friends with David, then it'll be good for me. So this then raises a question about when did this Amalekite get this crown and armlet? Now, he gets the crown and armlet, if you can remember back right from that timeline that we looked at before, that Saul dies, but it's then the next day that they strip Saul. So in chapter 1, in 31:1, Saul dies on that day. In 31:8, it's the next day that they come and strip Saul, and then they go and deal with his body hanging in with him in Bashan. So here's this day period, and most likely this Amalekite is watching all of this happen. And he's watching all of this happen, and he sees Saul die, and he waits and he waits, and then he just comes along as a scavenger later and picks this time up before the Philistines come and grab Saul's body. So most likely, that's what's happening with this Amalekite. So here, this Amalekite is, and he's lied. He has this armlet and this crown. Now we turn to David's response. And this comes to a big, big thing that we need to understand that happens in 2 Samuel. This change of administration, you might call it, this change of kingship. What type of king is David going to be? This is a very important question needs to be asked. Saul is dead. The throne now belongs to David as we know it in chapter 16. He's anointed next in king. In the coming chapters, we'll see a little bit of to and fro of what that actually looks like. But what does this actually look like? What is David's response? And our response might be celebration. Saul is dead. As the little green people or whatever they are, the munchkins in The Wizard of Oz, ding dong, the witch is dead. There's a celebration when the witch dies. And this is what maybe this Amalekite thought would happen now. David sits there and he's rejoicing. He's no longer running. He now is the king of Israel. What a joy. But what is David's response going to be? What type of king will David be? And we see this in verses 11 and 12. And David took hold of his clothes and tore them. And so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan, his son, and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. This is, I think, the central part of this passage that we're looking at this evening. David's response is grief, mourning, sorrow. He's been confronted. He's been in situations where he's had the ability to be able to take Saul's life for himself back in chapter 24. Do you listen to the words of men who say, behold, David seeks you harm. Behold, this day your eyes have seen how the Lord gave you today into my hand in the cave, and some told me to kill you, but I spared you. And I said I would not put my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. Or the story of Nabal, in chapter 25, and 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal and he died. And when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, blessed be the Lord who has avenged the insult I received by the hand of Nabal. And he has kept back his servant from wrongdoing. The Lord has returned his evil of Nabal on his own head. And the Lord sent and spoke to Abigail and to take her as his wife. Now he rejoiced when Nabal died because the Lord struck him dead. The Lord did it. But he doesn't rejoice when Saul dies. I think there's two reasons for that. He doesn't rejoice because this Amalekite has told him that he took Saul's life and seeks to rejoice in that. But also, he also doesn't rejoice because he's the Lord's anointed. He still realizes all the pain and the suffering and the turmoil that Saul has put him through. God still anointed him to be king over Israel. God still put him in that position. Now, that's a hard thing for us to grasp. And same again in chapter 26, a similar thing happens when the Lord, Saul's asleep in the middle of the camp with Abner there. And he writes in chapter 26, "The Lord rewards every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness. For the Lord gave you into my hand today, but I would not put out my hand against the Lord's anointed. Behold, as the Lord, as your life was precious this day in my sight, so may my life be precious in the sight of the Lord, and may he deliver me out of all tribulation." Now, this is the last time that David sees Saul. It's, you know, 18 months later that he goes down to Gath and goes then down to Ziklag with Achish. He then comes up. He doesn't see Saul again that we know of after this moment. But he says of Saul's life, that Saul's life is precious in the eyes of God. In the eyes of the Lord. It's precious that day in the eyes of the Lord. So he mourns for Saul. But he doesn't just mourn for Saul as well. He mourns for Saul. He mourns for the loss of Jonathan, his best friend, who has strengthened him in times of trouble, who have they've made covenants with one another, who loved one another. And not only he mourned for Saul, for Jonathan, but also the people of the Lord. This was not just a day of celebration. This was a great day of mourning, not just for Saul and the house of Saul, but the whole house of Israel, the whole nation of Israel. Israel was defeated. Once again, they were delivered back into the hand of the Philistines. This is what happened in the beginning of 1 Samuel, when Eli's house crumbled and fell. And the exact same thing happened. And now they're back into the hands of the Philistines. Remember back in chapter 4, almost you could see the similarities between these two stories. And a man of Benjamin ran from the battle line and came to Shiloh that same day with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. That's exactly how this Amalekite comes approaching to David. Came from Saul's camp and his clothes torn and his dirt on his head. And this is the exact repeat. And remember what happened in chapter 4. The ark was taken. And the Eli's grandson born. His name was Ichabod. The glory of God has departed. And here again, at the beginning of 1 Samuel chapter 2, we have this same bad news. The God apparently is defeated. The ark has not been captured, but Saul, the king, has fallen. And not only Saul, his son, Jonathan, his whole house is in ruin, but all of Israel is now back underneath the hand of the Philistines. It's not a day of rejoicing for David. It's a day of mourning. It's a dark day for the nation of Israel. You could also maybe see this conversation that David passes on to Solomon as he instructs his son, and Solomon takes what David has instructed in Psalm 24, verses 17 to 22. Solomon writes this in Proverbs, "Do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and let not your heart be glad when he stumbles, lest the Lord see it and be displeased, and turn away his anger from him. Fret not yourself because of evildoers, and be not envious of the wicked. For the evil man has no future, and the lamp of the wicked will be put out. My son, fear the Lord and the king, and do not join with those who do otherwise. For disaster will arise suddenly from them, and who knows the ruin that will come from them both." Here's this instruction that most likely David passes on to Solomon, don't rejoice in the day of the evildoer. When your enemy falls, don't rejoice. Don't let your heart be glad when he stumbles. So then the next question is, what is David going to do with this man? This Amalekite who has come. And what type of king is he going to be? Is he going to be a king of justice? Is he going to be a king that seeks to rule under God's reign? Does he listen to the law of God? That's the next question. He says, the blood be on your own head. We see this in verses 13 to 16. And David said to the young man who told him, where do you come from? And he answered, I'm the son of a sojourner, an Amalekite. David said to him, how is it that you were not afraid to put your hand to destroy God, the Lord's anointed? Then David called one of the young men and said, go, execute him, and struck him down so that he died. And he struck him down so he died. And David said to him, your blood be on your head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, I have killed the Lord's anointed. Now, before we turn to this passage in particular, we need to know that our culture is really shocked by death. We think death is horrendous. This type of stuff doesn't happen in front of us. But there's still a part of us that I think wants justice to be had of those that do great evil. Even Lee Harvey Oswald, he was shot 2 days after JFK. He assassinated JFK. But generally speaking, we don't know what it's like to really live in a society where capital punishment is a thing. And I don't want to go down that conversation of capital punishment, but we do need to understand that we do live in different times. Again, the narrator seeks to record what happened in history, not provided biased opinions of which is very uncommon for today. It's very rare for you to be able to read an article. I can often open an article, read an article, and then the first adjective I read, normally I can tell where the author stands on a certain policy. They use a policy like an excellent, a monumentous day. It's in favor of whatever they're talking about, or horrendous, you know, abysmal. All these type of adjectives that they use, you normally can tell. But here the narrator's not trying to give his biased opinion. He's trying to record history of what actually happened. But we also need to be cautious about putting our American criminal minds and laws in place in this time. We live in a day and a time where we have the ability to be able to test DNA, to be able to find evidences that we would not have even been able to find 100 years ago. But we also need to understand, even in a court of law, that you can have many different types of evidences. And those evidences go up or down depending on the circumstance, where the evidence comes from, the validity of that evidence, all these different types of things. And I get this not from my experience in criminal law, but watching TV shows. So I don't know how accurate it is, but there's many different types of evidences that you might have DNA of them at the scene. You might be able to have witnesses, and what are those witnesses reliable? Do they have good character? Is there an alibi? Are they not at the scene but somewhere else? Do they have motive? All these things are evidences that can be used in the court of law. But one of the greatest evidences that can be used in the court of law is something that happens in this passage, that you actually confess to the crime. You confessing to the crime almost alleviates all need to have any type of other evidence. If the person says, I did this, that almost will certainly be a guilty charge. And here, that's exactly what happened with this Amalekite person. He said, and David says that he says it twice, that he struck Saul down. He took the Lord's anointed. So what does the Mosaic law instruct those who commit treason? Now, I don't know if that's the best word for this. Treason, I think, has different layers. The Amalekite's not a season. He's a sojourner from somewhere. I'm not sure if that's the best word, but that's the only one that I could come up with. But there's frequent crimes in the Bible that are punishable by death underneath the Mosaic law. And often they're linked with the violation of taking someone's life. That the Mosaic law upholds the sanctity of life. Not even just the Mosaic law. We see this in Genesis chapter 9. After Noah gets off the ark, he makes a covenant. God makes a covenant with him. But God explains that whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. And we see this principle, a man being made in God's own image. And life then is valuable. And this flows throughout all of Scripture, but also through the Mosaic law. In the Mosaic law in Exodus chapter 21, whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint for you a place that he may flee. But if a man willingly attacks another to kill him by cunning, you shall take him from my altar and he may die. So if this so happens, here we see this different levels. If he goes and what we manslaughter, first degree, second degree murder in our court system, there's somewhat of equivalent here in Exodus, that if he deliberately goes and plans to take another man's life, that is worse than accidentally him walking into his hand and it happening in the heat of the moment. That's what we see here. But we do see that if he strikes a man and puts him to death, he shall be put to death. Again, that principle found in Genesis is found then. And then again in Leviticus chapter 24, whoever takes the human life shall be surely put to death. Whoever kills an animal shall make it good. Whoever kills a person shall be put to death. So again, we see this distinction between the sanctity of human life compared to the sanctity of animal life. The Bible emphasizes human life over animals. Not going too far into there. But one of the major things is we also see this sanctity of human life, especially when it comes to children. And in Leviticus chapter 20, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, say to the people of Israel, any one of the people of Israel or the strangers who sojourn in Israel who gives any of his children to Molech shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. I myself will set my face against that man and will cut him off from among his people because he has given one of his children to Molech to make my sanctuary unclean and to profane my holy name. If the people of the land do at all close their eyes to that man when he gives one of his children to Molech and do not put him to death, then I will set my face against that man and against his clan and I will cut them off from among their people. Him and all who follow him in whoring after Molech. So here we even see this other layer, not just humans and animals, but even humans and children. God has a strong sense of the sanctity of human life, especially children. You shouldn't sacrifice your children to Molech. He says that even if you turn your blind eye, you close your eyes and just pretend like a child that it's not happening, I will take it into my own hands. I will cut you off. And here, again, that question, what is David going to do in this situation? This man seemingly has helped his cause, his political cause, to be able to get power. How is David going to respond? It'd be quite simple to be able to say, yes, well, here's some land you can have. Thank you for taking Saul off my hands. But in this case, David rules that he is guilty. He is guilty, although he is lying. He says that he is guilty. And David's ruling is just. He can only go of what has happened. David didn't see the situation. This man comes up and tells him twice that he killed Saul. But that's where David's response comes. That the blood be on your head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, I have killed the Lord's anointed. Now we're glad of our different types of evidences in our court system, that maybe we'd be able to go back to DNA, to be able to go to phone records, to be able to see our association with this. But I think David's ruling here is just with the evidence that he's presented, especially the evidence he's presented from the man who comes and says that he wiped out Saul. And this he's guilty of this crime, which is punishable by death. And David shows ultimately that he is going to be a different type of king. The one who does not gloat in death, who rejoices in the suffering of others. But he does take it seriously. He does take this weight upon his shoulders seriously. As we look forward to Christ, who knows the truth and the heart, and he too will judge justly. He will do so justly and fair. David shows, I think, in this passage, a reason why God was preparing him in the chapters before for this position. We'll see this throughout his kingship. He understands those of that have been treated like a dog, and he treats them and elevates them. He understands those who have been treated unjustly. He understands the sanctity of human life, even if it is the life of Saul who wants you dead. Chapter 26, verses 10 to 11 says, "And David said, as the Lord lives, the Lord will strike him, or his day will come to die, or he will go down into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should put my hand against the Lord's anointed. But take now the spear that is in his hand, head, and the water jar, and let us go." This lesson here, which he learnt in chapters 24, 25, and 26, has now been put into place by him as he is almost king over Israel. He's ruling justly. He doesn't rejoice in the death of anyone, especially someone who's treated him like a dog. And David's heart breaks. He breaks for the death of Saul and Jonathan, but also as a true king of Israel. He mourns over the death of the sheep. He mourns over the death of the Israelites, the glory of God departing them back into the hands of the Philistines. That's why in verse 4 it explains that he comes and he says, "Many people have fallen." And David mourns on that day. Next week we're going to look at the lament that David writes of this day. He puts his feelings into words, and we'll look at that more in detail.
Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com. Seven Springs Presbyterian Church began in 1874 and is a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America located in Glade Spring, Virginia. Please join us for worship on Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for His glory and His gospel.